So we'll make a start now. Welcome everybody to the fourth seminar in the Unconscious Memories Network series. It's great to see you all. I'm Soan Park, the convener. I'll first say a few words about the network by way of invitation. This network was set up to develop ways in which you might reduce the conceptual gap between mind and brain with the focus on unconscious memory. And so far we have examined the neurobiology and literature of memory, the neuroscience of reading, and what literature and neuroscience can tell us about priming. Coming up in a couple of weeks is a seminar on Proustian memory led by Gordon Shepherd, the eminent neuroanatomist at Yale, and his daughter, Professor Kristen Shepherd Barr, who teaches in the English faculty here. We warmly invite your participation and collaboration, and so if you have any suggestions, just drop me a line. For those who have not attended this series before, what we do is hear one talk after another, pausing only very briefly for clarification questions. And after we've had both papers, we take a short break for drinks, and with drinks in hand, begin the discussion. So to turn to today's topic, neuroscience and psychoanalysis, I am delighted to introduce to you our chair, the Goldsmith Professor of English at Oxford, Laura Marcus. Many of us know her through her work on modernism, Virginia Woolf, and film. But perhaps with so many psychoanalysts in the room, Professor Marcus may be more familiar to you in the context of psychoanalysis. She has edited Freud's The Interpretation of Dreams, as well as a collection of interdisciplinary essays on the interpretation of dreams. And last year we saw both the publication of her landmark study, Dreams of Modernity, Psychoanalysis, Literature, Cinema, published by the Cambridge University Press, and the concise companion to Psychoanalysis, Literature and Culture, published by Blackwell Wiley. Please join me in welcoming our chair, Professor Marcus.
Thank you very much, Soan. I mean, it's a great honour and pleasure to be asked to chair this session, which I know a number of people, all of us, have been looking forward to, but the room is very crowded and that's excellent. I'm going to introduce our speakers one by one, as it were. So I'll first introduce our first speaker, Professor Richard Brown, who is a university research professor in the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia. But he has spent a good deal of his career here at Oxford, including completing a degree in zoology in Oxford, and he's returned as a senior visiting research fellow at St John's College, Oxford, recently, and also visiting professorship at Wolfson College, which he held last year. The list of his achievements, research, the posts he's held is very long. I will just single out a few. He was president of the International Behavioural and Neurogenetics Society, and president of the Canadian Society for Brain Behaviour and Cognitive Science. And his work has been on neurological disorders through mouse models, which we will, I'm sure, hear more about, and working on Alzheimer's disease, on Fragile X syndrome, ADHD, and other neurological disorders. And he has also written wonderful work more on the history of science, and perhaps we might be able to ask more about that in question time. But today he's going to be talking to us on the question of multiple memory systems in the brain, integrating conscious and unconscious memory pathways. So give him a very big welcome. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank very much Professor Soan Park for inviting me to this symposium, and everyone for making the sunshine. As was mentioned in the introduction, most of our work these days is on mouse models of Alzheimer's disease. And what I want to talk about is the problem of trying to understand mouse models of any disease and translating that information to human disorders. So we flip back and forth from the human situation to the mouse situation. So HM was probably the most famous person in psychology and neuroscience of memory. He died recently. And he's famous because he's been a long-term patient. He had epilepsy, and he had a bilateral removal of his medial temporal lobes, which caused enormous problems with memory. And Brenda Milner from Montreal Neurological Institute, a student of Donald Hebb, went and did the first experiments on HM. Since the 1950s, when this began, there's been an endless series of HM. He's been studied in every possible human learning and memory experiment that you can imagine. And this is a review paper by Suzanne Corkin in 2002 of all the studies done on HM up till then, and there have been more recent reviews and obituaries of HM, of everything we've learned from HM. And what I want to start out with is the question, HM had his medial temporal lobes removed, his hippocampus, many other areas of the brain. What could he do and what couldn't he do? So this is from Suzanne Corkin's article. So what was impaired in HM? A picture memory test, word stem completion, category decision, lexical decision. What seemed to be normal? Pattern recognition, word stem completion with familiar words, exemplar production, fragment completion, homophore spelling, familiar words, pseudo words, novel words. So even though he'd lost a big chunk of his brain, a big chunk of his memory, he still could do some things. And the day this experiment was done, the world of the neuroscience of learning and memory changed. So Brenda Milner would go to HM's room and she'd say, "Hello, do you remember me? No, I've never seen you before in my life. Do you remember this test? No, I've never done this test before in my life." And the test was to take a pencil and trace the lines of this star while looking in a mirror. And this is the 10 trials, day one, 10 trials, day two, 10 trials, day three. And his errors went down to almost zero by the third day. Each day he said he'd never done this test before. So it was clear that memory was not just memory. Memory must have at least two components, a conscious, explicit memory, and a sort of unconscious, procedural or implicit memory. So in preparing for this, I was concerned that I didn't know what the unconscious was, although I have had surgery and been under anesthetic, and I do sleep. So there are times, and I was once in a car crash where I woke up on the side of the road with people saying, "Is he dead? Is he dead?" I said, "No, I'm not dead," although I was covered in blood and looked dead. So unconscious, not conscious, knowing one oneself, etc., etc., you can read all these, designating mental processes of which a person is not aware, but which have powerful effects on his or her attitudes, and as we'll see in the second talk today, in Freudian theory, designating processes activated by desires, fears, or memories which are unacceptable to the conscious mind, maybe we'll have a critique of this, so repressed, also designating that part of the mind or psyche in which such processes operate, from the Oxford English Dictionary. If I look in a dictionary of psychology and look at unconscious memory, just generally implicit memory, unconscious cognitive processes involving thinking, reasoning, judging, problem solving, which take place without consciousness, see incubation, a period of brooding required to bring something to a point where it's form and substance, in cognitive psychology, a period of time which no conscious effort is made to solve a problem, and the solution comes to you. So there's something about unconscious memory and cognition. It's like the problem, the solution just comes to you. Oh, isn't that interesting? You don't have to really touch this very hard, do you? Implicit memory, explicit memory then, you think of things, facts, dates, names, recall and recognition types of memory. Implicit memory, as I like to say, procedural memory, learning to ride a bicycle, learning to draw this star backwards. And people with amnesia, you can say, well, they've lost their memory, but what does that mean? And this leads into the whole world of multiple intelligences and multiple memory systems. So you have, so where is memory located in the brain? And if you're a phrenologist, there it is somewhere there. We're all phrenologists, it turns out. So you had Larry Squire. This is one of my favorite drawings. I'm trying to think of about 10 best drawings in neuroscience, and this is one of those drawings that really spells things out. It's 1996, but still worth using. You've got long-term memory divided into implicit and explicit memory. We've got HMs, medial temporal lobe there, facts and events. We've got learning to ride a bicycle, motor skills, the strata, priming, which you had a seminar on here, simple classical conditioning, fear conditioning, conditioned emotional responses involving the amygdala, and also an occasion the hippocampus, idling conditioning, the cerebellum, and habituation and sensitization involving reflex pathways. This is such a favorite figure of mine that I've collected every version I could ever find. I'm not going to show you them all, but this is from David Sweat's book. And I know Soana, I mentioned David Sweat to Soana, because he's an artist as well as a neuroscientist, and in his book, every chapter begins with a painting that he did himself. But here he's got unconscious learning, unconscious storage, some types of subject to conscious recall, although I'm not sure about taste. Unconscious recall, Pavlovian conditioning, etc., and then conscious learning and working memory. So a different type of division of labor of the memory systems. And this is a paper by Catherine Henke on altering the way you see this. And I should have deleted that one and just kept this one. Because what she did is say, well, we can look at memory in terms of rapid encoding and flexible associations, episodic memory, hippocampus and neural cortex, slow encoding of rigid associations through basal ganglia, cerebellum, neural cortex, and procedural memory, classical conditioning, semantic memory, and the rapid encoding of single unitized paradigmal gyrus, neural cortex. So just about, there's like schools of multiple memory systems almost. And you can ask a more detailed question. You can say, well, what is the neural circuitry underlying of memory? And this, it's possibly the neural circuitry of a hippocampal type memory. You've got the hippocampus connected to the subiculum, the entorhinal cortex, pararhinal cortex, through the sensory systems of the thalamus, the neuroendocrine and emotional hypothalamus, the basal forebrain, the parietal lobe, temporal lobe, frontal lobe, and you can try and trace the circuits involved in any memory, and people are working on that just down the road. I was there the other day. You can ask the question of what is the neurochemical basis of memory? And for this, all I've chosen is the cholinergic system. You've got the cholinergic cell groups with acetylcholine and all the pathways. There's the nucleus basalis of Maynard, which I spent 4 years working on, and they didn't publish my paper, not that I'm bitter. And it has cholinergic pathways to all parts of the brain that could be involved in learning and memory and are thought to underlie some of the problems in Alzheimer's disease. And then you can go deeper to biochemical and molecular biology mechanisms, calcium calmodulin, CAMK2, CAMK4, protein kinases, Krebs, and protein synthesis, brain growth, neurotrophic factor, and changes in the structure of this cell associated with learning and memory and long-term biochemical changes. And last week I heard a talk on PKM zeta, which I thought was dead, but it's having a resurgence. So there's a whole world of, I'll tell you about it. There's a whole world of molecular biology involved in learning. Now, this is one of my favorite papers, and by a twist of fate, the author, Rob McDonald, is here on leave at Oxford. Stand up, Rob. He's one of the great experts in Canada and the world on multiple memory system theory. And this was your PhD, wasn't it? And to show you how important this paper was, last year it was completely reprinted in Behavioral Neuroscience. Did you say it was reprinted twice? Or just that time in Behavioral Neuroscience last year, 2013? Yeah, 2013 it was reprinted. So this is an important paper because it follows on from Brendan Milner's research with HM on trying to dissociate memory systems. And what Rob and my old pal Norm White did at McGill is use an 8-arm radial maze, and you can bait different arms with food, and you can have different rules for the rat or mouse to learn the 8-arm radial maze. And you can set up different rules and do different lesions of the brain. So this is the experiment two with your neurotoxic lesions. And so if you lesion the hippocampus and ask them to do a wind shift paradigm, so you bait four arms, they go to an arm, they get food, then they have to go to another arm to get food. And with a hippocampal lesion, they make a lot of errors. The other lesions, they don't make as many errors. You can also have a condition cue preference. You can put a little light on one of the arms, and the animal has to learn to go to where the light is to get food. And if you do a lateral amygdala lesion, they can make that discrimination. And then you can have a wind-stay situation where you put food in an arm, and the animal has to go back to the arm a second time and get another pellet of food. And if you give a dorsal striatum lesion, you get poor performance in that. So a beautiful study of different effects of lesions of different memory systems and how they encode different types of information. And I'm glad Rob was here because I told him this is one of my favorite papers and I'd forgot till this afternoon when I checked that it was in my talk. So we move now to Alzheimer's disease, to humans with Alzheimer's disease. And we asked many questions, and this question comes from research on cancer. When you research on cancer, the question is, what is the first cell that gets cancer and how does it spread? And so you can ask, what is the first cell that gets Alzheimer's disease, and what's the system that it goes through? And so you have patients with damage to the hippocampus only, patients with damage to the medial temporal lobes. Much like HM, you have some types of learning and memory that are impaired, and some types of learning and memory that are preserved. And you can start to try and dissociate what does it mean to have a hippocampal system that's impaired? What does it mean to have episodic memory that's impaired? What kind of memory is preserved? And I'm going to go into this in a bit more detail in a second. But the essence is, when you lose your memory, you don't lose your memory. You lose one type of memory, and the others may be spared, at least for some time until the degeneration hits those other areas. And so this is a case of piano playing in Alzheimer's disease. I mean, we often hear about people who forget the name of their children, forget where they live, forget their to recognize their husband, but can still play the piano. And so this was a rating of one patient in language abilities. Oh, I can't read some of this. Whatever that says, can you read it? Yeah, and what's that say?
Tension.
Tension, and the scores there with the stars on them show ones that are preserved to some extent. The others have declined. And then sequencing, remote implicit memory, and autobiographical memory. So here you see the sequencing, they failed by year three. The control subjects are getting scores of 10, they're getting scores of 2. Whereas with some implicit memory, and the controls are getting 5.6 and they're getting 4.4. No significant difference. Controls 10.6, they're 8.2. So a number of things are preserved in these people, or this one person with Alzheimer's disease. And what's interesting is when you start looking at what goes wrong and what's preserved, musical knowledge, the ability to name that tune and to say what song it is, that declines each year, whereas the motor control part, the performance aspect, is maintained at 8 out of 8, whatever the total score is, 8, 8, 8, doesn't change over the years. 5, 5, 4 doesn't change. And here, this is the piano playing skill. Many of the results, the F value is less than 1, so there's only 2 significant differences, 2 significant declines over 3 years. The rest don't decline significantly. Rhythm, tempo, tone quality, posture, the motor control parts are not declining, whereas the naming the song part is. This is a paper then with different patients, all of whom had some motor skill. So the objective is to describe cognitive skills in patients with dementia. What can they do? And they look at their particular skill. So one patient continued to play the trombone in a Dixieland band, although he could not name the songs he was playing. Another continued to solve adult jigsaw puzzles, skillet canasta, dominoes. The fifth remained skillful at contact bridge, although he could not name the suits or articulate simple bidding rules. So the motor component is staying there, and the cognitive component seems to be deteriorated. Memory for music is interesting. A lot of people at McGill University do memory for music. And memory for music has two components, as I said, the naming of the tune and the being able to play the tune. And so the explicit and implicit musical memory functions. The implicit, the being the motor control, the ability to play it, continues to be spared in patients with AD. The explicit musical memory, recognizing familiar, unfamiliar melodies, is impaired. So you get this dissociation, the things that Rob does. So we moved to our mice, our wonderful world of mice. We've tested billions of mice over the last number of years. You can have a lot of background strains of mice, genetically embedded strains, but C57 Black 6 is the most common mouse. The DBA, our little friend, C3H. And then you get transgenic Alzheimer's mouse models. They have genes put into them. So they have an APP gene and a PS1 gene. They have five different genes, the five times and the three times. And I'll tell you a story about each of these mice. One story per mouse, so as not to take up too time. So we have tested seven different mouse models. Everything differs. These names, every letter, every number, every punctuation mark has a meaning. And so we've abbreviated the names. The genes are put in different ways. They express different genes, and they have different background strains. All of that confounds things, but I won't go into that now. I talked about it last week in physiology. There are also a number of different memory tests you can do. The Morris Water Maze, a spatial test, the Barnes Maze, spatial test, Rotarod, a learning trotted bicycle test, odor preferences, fear conditioning, visual discrimination, prepulse inhibition of startle, etc., etc., etc. So you have huge batteries of tests, like we called it years ago our mouse IQ test. So the Delta E9 mouse, a double transgenic mouse, I'll tell you the story of the Barnes Maze, because it illustrates a number of things, and we've published this. In the Barnes Maze, the mouse starts out in the middle, there's a loud noise, there's bright light, and you can run to one of these holes and find a hidey hole. And you record the time and the pathway and the latency, how it gets there, what it does, what's going on in the mouse's mind as it tries to solve this problem. And we can do it over a number of days. I should say something more. So that what we do is we test it for a number of days with an escape hole here, let's say, and then one day we surprise it and move the escape hole over there. So just when it thinks it knows what it's doing, it has to rethink it, sort of like going down the Headington Road when it's all jammed up with roadworks. Let's see what happened. I've touched something. Okay, go away, go away. This is where we get confused. Next, I guess next is what I want. So this is the latency, and that's the number of errors. And we've got females and males. The white dots are the wild type, the black dots are the transgenic. And you see the transgenics are taking longer and making more errors in both females and males. Females are slightly worse than males. So you've got a learning difference. When you reverse it, they all get confused, and then they relearn it again. And the bigger that is, the better they've learned over here a spatial technique. So now the mice can learn this in a number of different ways. Hopefully I've got it here. The mice can run around at random and bump into the correct hole. And this is the amount of their trials they run around at random. They don't know anything to do at the beginning, but gradually they stop running around at random at least the wild type do. The transgenics still run around at random a bit more. When you finish running around at random, you can say, okay, if I go there, I just go right. You go in a sequence, a procedural rule. So what they develop a procedural rule, and the transgenics work by procedural more. But when you discover where the hole is, you can look around there and say, ah, there's the doorway. I don't have to go around the wall. I don't have to go around it. I can focus on that green sign and go right to the door. So they develop a spatial strategy. And the wild type are much better at developing a spatial strategy than the transgenic. So their little mouse minds are working differently. The normal mouse, the control mouse, is more rapidly getting rid of its random behavior. It's developing a procedural task and then switching into a spatial task. And so you can say they have two types of learning, a procedural learning. Every time I touch something, I don't even have to touch it very much. Okay, end show. No, I don't want end show. I want next. Thank you, little machine. Now you do a memory test. At the end of the day, so you put it in there with no escape hole. You say, where does the mouse think the escape hole is? So females and males, females make more errors on this than males, and there's not as big a difference between them. There's the correct hole. And the one next to it, and the one on the other side. Not as big a difference between the females, whether transgenic or wild type. But the males, a huge difference. There's the wild type males, and there's the ADP males. They're not as good at spatial orientation as the wild type males. But then we ask the question, what happens in the reversal memory test? So you used to go to the door over there, the exit over there. Now that's the correct one. So what you do? Well, you go to the correct one, or the one next to it, not very many errors. The wild type are better than the transgenic, but what if it's not there? You go to the old place. Now that means the little mouse brain has two memories. It has today's memory, where how to get out of the maze, yesterday's memory, and last week's memory, how it used to get out of the maze. So you can't infer that the little mouse has only one type of memory or one type of learning. It can flip back and forth. So let's go to the five times mouse and the rotor rod, the learning to ride a bicycle task. You put them on this rod, you turn it on, and it turns slightly faster and slightly faster. So they have to coordinate themselves on it, and they can learn to balance on it and to stay on it. And we test these mice from birth to death. 3, 6, 9, 12, 15 months of age. You see, at 3 months of age, these two are the transgenic, that's the female. They're fine. At 6 months of age, they're fine. At 9 months of age, the transgenic are falling off sooner. At 12 months of age, they're getting to be toast. And at 15 months of age, they can hardly balance on this beam at all. Notice in general, the females are better than the males. They say, well, you've got a genotype difference and you've got a sex difference. Well, you would be fooled. So what you have to do, oh, isn't that annoying? I guess I'll be talking about that later. So you've got now a motor control problem in these five times mice and a motor learning problem. If you can't stay on the rod, you can't learn. These are exactly the same mice tested by poor Tim every 3 months for most of his life. And so they know what to do. They've done it before, but they're failing because of motor control problems. Let's look at the Morris water maze. Here they swim. You put them in at various places, and they swim to this platform in this cloudy water. We run them to this platform for a few days, and then we trick them and move it over there. Then we give them a visible platform. I won't talk about that. They get four trials a day for 3 days, and then we switch them over and see what their little mouse mind is thinking. So this again tells you many things. Here are the same mice, 3, 6, 9, 12, 15 months of age, and the males show this shift here, suggesting they're using a spatial approach, the females not so much. At 6 months of age, hard to tell them apart. At 9 months of age, at 12 months of age, you're starting to have a sex difference, and these poor transgenic mice are not doing well compared to the wild types. And by 15 months of age, they're perfectly separate. It is mice can hardly do it at all, whereas the wild types are not only learning rapidly, they're using a spatial approach. So now you've got a big separation in their ability. And is it confounded by motor control? Some of it is, but some of it's not. You look at the memory test, you just take out that platform and ask them where they think they're going. We'll just look at this one. Correct. 3 months of age, no problem. 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, 15 months. The transgenics can no longer remember. They're not using a spatial approach. But they can still solve the problem, not so well. So maybe the tests aren't hard enough. We turn to Rob McDonald's experiment with Norm Wright, and to Vin Cruzio, my friend in now in France, who developed an 8-arm radio maze for mice. So these are the little cues. You can put a pellet in any one of these arms. You can do it different ways. And we baited 4 arms at random. And if they go into a baited arm and get the food, they get it correct. If they go into an unbaited arm, they have a reference memory error. If they go into a baited arm and get the food and go back into it, they have a working memory error. So they're juggling a lot of little mouse thoughts in their mind. And we test them. These are different groups of mice at each age, 2, 6, 9, 12, 15 months of age. It doesn't matter the working memory errors are higher at every age in the transgenic mice, so are the reference memory errors. And occasionally you get a sex difference. So they're not having really age-related effects, but they're having problems. It doesn't look like a big problem when you average them all together, but they are making more and more errors. So now what about the motor function of the transgenic mice? This is what I want to talk about. So there is the wild-type mice, and there is the transgenic mice. And every time I explain this, I get it wrong, because the transgenic mice are doing better than the controls. It doesn't matter who tests them. It doesn't matter what age they're tested. We replicated this now at least 4 times. So the transgenic mice are doing better in this motor control problem. Even they did worse in working memory and reference memory. And the females are doing better than the males. There's the females of each one. They think, the females are better. But now you have to remember, males are chubbier than females. So if you just do a correlation of body weight, there's a high correlation of body weight, especially when you get to the last day, day 5. And it doesn't matter whether you're male or female. The lighter ones do better than the heavier ones. And just that the fact, on average, females are lighter. So the sex difference washes out when you control for body weight. But the genotype difference stays. Why is a mouse with 3 different Alzheimer's transgenes doing a better job at motor, not just motor coordination, but motor learning? A procedural type of learning, implicit learning, not explicit learning. So what have we learned about this from these just small examples of 720 experiments I've done in the last 10 years? The Delta E9, the double transgenic mouse, has poor spatial learning. It uses procedural, not spatial learning, has poor spatial memory. The procedural learning and memory in the 5 times mouse is poor, maybe because of their poor motor control, has reduced motor function. It also has poor spatial learning and memory. Triple transgenics, for some unknown reason, probably because of the tau gene, have very good procedural memory, reduced spatial reference and working memory. So you see these different memory systems gradually pulling apart. So what did we learn about learning? And what I learned in the last hour is I forgot to put an arrow down there. So you start out, whether you're a person or a mouse, you don't know what you're doing. You have a random approach. Then you develop a procedural approach, go right, and then you can develop a spatial search or a semantic search or episodic search, which I gave in the talk last week, so if you don't know what this is, I'm sorry, we can discuss it. But you can go back and forth. If your spatial search doesn't work, you can go back to a procedural search. If that doesn't work, no doubt you can go back to a random search. And fourth, so you've got different, it's not like you're fixated in one way of doing things. You can flip in different types of learning, different mechanisms. So what about memories? Well, you can store a memory. So where the platform is in the Barnes Maze this time, where platform was last time, where it is last time. And so if this memory doesn't work, you might flip to another memory. Well, what's the mechanism of this? You ought to invite Rob McDonald, because he has worked on that a lot. You ought to invite him to give a talk, and he can answer these questions. Well, now we come to memory networks. And this is a case from my own life. Last time I was in England, I got on the plane at Heathrow, and one of my former students, he'd worked with me for about 5 years, got on the plane behind me. And he sat right behind me. And his wife, do you think I could remember his name? So I knew he went to King's College in Halifax. He did his honors thesis with me on the placebo effect. He got married. His wife was named Caitlin. She was sitting beside him. He was big in tango dancing. He enjoyed wine. He lived in Montreal. He did medicine at McGill. His wife bought him a piano when they got an apartment together. Why could I not remember his name? The whole damn flight, I'm thinking, what the hell is this kid's name? He's sitting right behind me. I've known him for years. I finally said, I can't remember his name. Ben. Of course it's Ben. Why? But why? Why? Why is that gone when all this stays? I could tell you everything, how he met his wife, how they were both my students in different years, how they both went to begin. Like, why did this name go? Am I getting Alzheimer's, or am I just aged and feeble? Or is that a common problem? So how do we understand memory changes in aging and Alzheimer's disease? Well, one question is, which memories are lost and which remain? And what's that neural mechanism underlying the lost and the remain memories? If explicit or conscious memories are lost, can you try and use implicit or unconscious memories or networks to aid memory? And so how do we understand why some memory systems fail and others don't? If only Donald Hebb was still alive, maybe he could help, because he developed the idea of cell assemblies, and I was lucky enough to get his book reprinted and write an introduction to it, and he came up with the idea of these cell assemblies. So I'm going to ask you about cell assemblies and psychoanalysis. I've already written the questions in the public process group. So what's going on? Can we use Hebb cell assemblies to think about memories? Is this my memory of Ben and I've lost that bit with his name in it? Or is this my memory of Ben and I lost a B part of it? And rest remains. How is it that so much remains when you can't remember one certain thing? How is it in Alzheimer's disease that maybe this system fails your cognitive memory, this motor system? That's the visual system here, 17 and 18. Broadman areas. How is it that they remain and one fails? It may be that in different clinical disorders, one system fails and you develop a clinical disorder, whereas other systems are normal. How do we understand neurofunctioning in terms of these large networks? And so there we are. There's our brain. There we are thinking about these things. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Well, for our second speaker, and I'm sure Professor Mark Soames is going to be familiar to many, if not most of us here. I first came upon his work some years ago, and I think the fascination for many of us, as it were, coming from the humanities, is that he has been one of the few people, it seems to me, to try and connect neuroscience with psychoanalysis. I'm sure we'll be talking more about this later. Going back to the early Freud, the Freud that, as it were, Lacanian psychoanalysis pushed out because we wanted script and text and narrative. But we're now going back to the early Freud of the neuropsychology, and Professor Soames is editing the complete neuroscientific works of Sigmund Freud, and amazingly being the new translator, the retranslator of the revised standard edition of the complete psychological works of Freud, the 24 volumes of Strachey's work. So in addition to all that, he is a chair of neuropsychology at the University of Cape Town, and honorary lecturer in neurosurgery at St Bartholomew's, Royal London School of Medicine, honorary professor in neurological surgery at Weill Cornell Medical School in New York. He's a practicing analyst with membership of the New York Psychoanalytic Society, and he's honorary fellow of the American College of Psychiatrists. His list of publications is much too long for me to even make a stab at it, with over 300 articles and or 5 books. But his most recent book with Oliver Turnbull is The Brain and the Inner World. He continues as a member of the British Psychoanalytic Society and the South African Psychoanalytic Association, of which he's president and research chair of the International Psychoanalytic Association. So really someone wonderful for us, with amazing footholds in both camps, I suppose. So please welcome him to
So since you mentioned that I'm president of the South African Psychoanalytical Association, I must tell you it has 8 members. One president and 7 vice presidents. I'm very glad to have been asked to give this talk because I like talking to non-neuroscientists. Especially I enjoy the questions because it's not boring. You get to think about things from an entirely different perspective. I also was glad to be asked to give this talk because I think that some recent work I've been doing with 2 close colleagues of mine on the brain mechanisms of consciousness is, I think, of particular interest to the sorts of things that I understand motivate this series of seminars. So I'll just dive straight into that. There's some new developments in our field in relation to brain mechanisms of consciousness that I've been working on together with Jaak Panksepp in Washington and with Tony DiMarzio in California, and more recently with, and to a lesser extent, with Carl Friston here in London. And let's see if they do interest you. I certainly think that they'll provoke those of my neuroscientific colleagues who are here. We start with the question as to where consciousness comes from. What is it in the brain that generates consciousness? And the common sense view, and I think it was probably from common sense that Hume and Locke and that lot also derived the view, is that it comes from our sensory perceptual modalities. Consciousness, so obviously, you know, the contents of our consciousness is so obviously made up of what we perceive, what we see, what we hear, and to a lesser extent, you know, touch, taste, smell, and so on. And of course, our cognitions have the same sort of content, the same sort of qualities, the same sorts of properties as our external perceptual modalities. And so we, following in the footsteps of those great philosophers, we think of our cognitions derived from memories to ultimately also be derived from our external perceptual modalities. That this, in fact, is the totality of the stuff that makes up our consciousness. And as I say, it squares so well with our common sense. The problem is, it appears to be completely wrong. Consciousness is not generated by our perceptual inputs or the memory traces attaching to them at all. Consciousness, and this is not news, consciousness is generated in a primitive part of the brain, in the upper brain stem, very ancient parts of the brain. And this we discovered in the 1940s. In fact, it was such a great surprise in the 1940s that we still haven't entirely gotten our minds around it, which is why this is old news, but also new news. Magoon and Maruzzi did a series of experiments in the 40s in which they sought to establish brain mechanisms of sleep and wakefulness, which is more or less the same thing as brain mechanisms of consciousness. And it was to their very great surprise that they found, in a series of experiments, the most dramatic of which was severing all the sensory inputs in the brains of cats, with the prediction that the cat would fall asleep because there's no consciousness streaming in anymore. And that simply isn't what happened. The cats not only stayed awake, they were very awake, quite agitated to be without any sensory inputs. They still did go to sleep and wake up, But this was according to the normal sleep-waking cycle. It didn't have anything to do with the deprivation of sensory inputs. And in that same series of experiments, there were some single-cell recordings that Magoon and Maruzzi did, and it was in these recording studies that they found that the structures that are generating the consciousness, the structures that wake the cat up in the morning and put the cat to sleep again at night, that those structures are here. So that part of the brain has very little connection with the external world, especially the deep nuclei that I'm referring to here. Of course, there are parts of the brain stem which are in connection with the outside world, but the structures that generate our consciousness, that generate our wakefulness, that make us conscious, that make us different from comatose people, are deeply embedded in the upper brain stem, and consciousness is generated from there endogenously. Consciousness is a property not of our perceptual modalities, not of the streaming in of information from the outside world, but rather it's a property of the brain. The brain itself, in a very ancient part, generates the consciousness. Now, as I told you, this is something we've known since the 40s. Penfield and Jaspers did other experiments on humans, cases of epilepsy surgery, in which they were able to confirm Magoon and Maruzzi's observations and came to the same conclusion. They called this the centrencephalic region, and they came to the conclusion that this is the part of the brain where consciousness is generated, that if you're going to have a generalized seizure in which consciousness is lost, it has to recruit this part of the brainstem, which, as I said, they call the centrencephalic region. So why is this? Why do I need to tell you about this? As I said, it's such old news. The reason why it's both old and new news is because we used a kind of a semantic fudge to get in order to keep our theories the same as they were, despite the fact that we had overwhelming evidence that our theories were wrong. Our theory being, as I said, the commonsensical one, that the contents of our consciousness are derived from those parts of our brain which receive and represent the activities of our peripheral sensory organs. That is to say, the organs which transduce information about the state of the outside world. So the semantic fudge that we came up with was to divide consciousness into two components. And we said that the contents of consciousness, the stuff that's filling your mind right now, that this, we can keep it exactly the same as it was. Contents of consciousness are derived from your external perceptual organs and ultimately represented on surfaces of the cortex in the way that we always thought that it was. This unwelcome news down here, we decided to call this the level of consciousness. We called it wakefulness, and we distinguished this sort of quantitative dimension of consciousness from the qualitative dimension. The qualities of our consciousness are what we're experiencing now, and the fact that we're awake is a kind of, you know, background quantitative, a necessary prior condition for us to be able to have qualities of consciousness and contents of consciousness. Okay, so that's from the 50s onwards, you know, that's how we got around this this unwelcome fact. But really, and this brings me now closer to the present, although some of the things I'm going to tell you we've also known for years, really that just isn't correct. It isn't correct to say, well, let me put it in an absolute nutshell. It feels like something to be awake, is what we've realized. That there is a content to wakefulness, that there is a quality to wakefulness. And that content and that quality is the word I've just used, feelings. Affective, emotional feelings are not derived from the external perceptual world. You can't see rage. You can see somebody who's in a rage, but the rage, the feeling of rage, or of sadness, or of anxiety, or whatever, these feeling states, these emotional feeling states, are contents of consciousness, and they don't come from our external perceptual modalities. In fact, the contents of our consciousness are made up of more than seeing, hearing, smelling, etc. The contents are also made up of these feelings. How could we have left that out? I hope that you literature people, you know, will forgive us. But we did sort of leave that out for decades, that the contents of consciousness include feelings. And that those feelings, not only are they not generated on the external cortical surface, but that very same part of the brain which generates the so-called level of consciousness, wakefulness, the so-called quantitative dimension of consciousness, is also the part of the brain that generates the feelings. And in fact, the things that the psychoactive substances that psychiatrists tinker with are, for the most part, the source nuclei of the neurotransmitter systems that they're fiddling with are in this part of the brain. So we might even have been able to infer it from that simple fact, that why is it that all the psychotropic medications concern, you know, the neurotransmitters that are released at the terminals of these systems, which activate the entire forebrain. It's not only a part of the brain that should concern coma care and anaesthetist specialists, but also psychiatrists. And as I say, in fact, it is the part of the brain that they're tinkering with, even though they never seem to think about it that way. The fact is, as Penfield and Jaspers observed in the 50s, you can remove great swathes of cortex. What you do is you lose certain types of information processing, but you can't render the patient unconscious by removing cortex. The cortex simply isn't the organ of the conscious mind. The organ of the conscious mind is down here. Now, there are absolutely oodles of evidence for that, and I'm just going to show you what I think is the most sort of, in a way, the most moving evidence, and in some senses also the most dramatic evidence for what I've been telling you, which I'll just restate. Consciousness is an endogenous property of the brain. It's generated from below. It is not something that streams in from outside. That if the consciousness that's generated from below is switched off, then all the rest of consciousness is switched off. If you lesion this tiny structure that I'm pointing to now, which is called the periaqueductal gray, which is the size of a jelly bean, and there's one of them inside of your head right now, if you damage that structure, you will go into coma absolutely definitely. It is a 100% certain prediction. It is impossible to remain conscious without an intact periaqueductal gray. That can't be said for anything up here. And as I say, you can remove whole hemispheres. And I'm going to show you now cases of hydranencephaly, where the child is born with no forebrain. They're born with no cortex. These little slivers of cortex here are totally non-functional. There's no white matter connecting them to thalamus. They therefore can't be activated. And in any event, if you look at them histologically, they are gliosed. So even these little flaps of cortex here are effectively functionally absent. But look at this. These are children who have a brainstem and nothing else. Are these children conscious? You bet your bottom dollar they are. They have a normal sleep-waking cycle. Unfortunately, for obvious reasons, they are given to seizures. They're given, in fact, especially to absence seizures. And their parents have no difficulty recognizing when the child's awake, when the child's asleep, when the child's had a seizure and is in an absent state, and when they're back again. So they are conscious. And I hope you can see from this little sequence, by the way, these photographs are shown to you with the permission of the parents. This little sequence here, this is the child without a forebrain, without any cortex. Here, her little sibling is put on her chest, and she goes, the sort of emotional response of the pleasure of having the little baby put on her chest. And here is another child, also hydranencephalic, absolutely no forebrain, absolutely no cortex. And she is obviously not only conscious, but emotionally present, which is the important part of the story. I want to go back and reiterate something that I've said already, but say it slightly more specifically. I've said that all of the consciousness that is generated in the forebrain, that is to say the somatic sensation, the vision, the hearing, the parts of the cortex that generate these different properties, these different modalities that we thought made up the totality of the contents of our consciousness, none of these structures generate consciousness unless they are activated from below. You can remove any one of those. You can remove the whole of the forebrain, as I showed you. You don't remove consciousness. All you remove is certain types of information processing. But if you lesion this area over here, you lose all of that type of consciousness. Therefore, and here's my point, therefore what we're talking about is a hierarchical relationship in which these types of consciousness, which are not intrinsic to this part of the brain, consciousness is not intrinsic to this part of the brain, the consciousness is derived from down here. This is what activates the rest of the brain, and absolutely that's what we always knew. This activates the forebrain, and it is this area here that activates, therefore, the consciousness that we thought came from the external world. And we just have to get our heads around that, if you'd excuse the pun. We just have to get our heads around the fact that the consciousness does not come with the perceptual information. The perceptual information registered in cortex and the cognition derived from it is intrinsically unconscious. Some of the things that you heard just now in Richard Brown's talk refers to a whole sea of information that we've gathered over the last few decades in cognitive neuroscience about all the things that the forebrain can do without consciousness. You know, there's just about no cognitive operation that can't be performed without consciousness, unless you start being tautological and saying, well, episodic memory can't be performed without consciousness, and that's only because the definition of episodic memory is that it's conscious memory, that there has to be a sentient subject there having the memory. But reading, solving problems, priming, as you heard, learning the most complex of tasks, all manner of things, decision making of all kinds, all of this cognitive gymnastics that we are so proud of and that we attribute to our forebrains because we have so much of it in comparison to the mice and rats that you heard about earlier. All of this stuff, brilliant as it is, commendable as it is, and proud as we should be of it, does not intrinsically require consciousness. The consciousness, as I say, comes from down here, and there's a hierarchical relationship between all these operations and this stuff down here. Now, I've told you already that this is emotional, that this sort of consciousness is not without quality, it's not without content. And when I say that there's a hierarchical relationship between these two aspects of consciousness, I hope that you can see implicit in what I'm saying is also this, that the core, basic, raw stuff of consciousness, the fundamental type of consciousness, the type of consciousness upon which all this other type of consciousness depends, is affective. Consciousness, in its most fundamental form, is affect, is feeling. And when you think about all of the things that we have been puzzling about in cognitive neuroscience, when we ask ourselves, but what is the consciousness for? You know, why do we need consciousness if we can do all of these brilliant things cognitively without consciousness? What does the consciousness add? It boils down to that, to what I've just said to you. It's feeling. That's what you can't have without consciousness. Feeling your way into your cognitions and feeling your way through your cognitions. There are some sort of comical problems that cognitive neuroscience have got, like scientists have got themselves into, like, for example, the famous binding problem, you know, where they ask, how can it happen? The information all arrives here in V1, V2, and then it gets absolutely fragmented in the brain as we process all of the visual stuff. And then over there, the movement happens, and over there, the color gets added, and over there, you discover whose face you're looking at. How come all of it gets sent back into this, you know, combined bound experience that I have? It's all of that has got to do with the misconception that that's where the consciousness is being generated. The consciousness is down here. It's yours. It's endogenous. It has to do with my state, and it's your consciousness, and you are activating your perceptions, and you are experiencing them. Your presence inside of all of that cognition is what binds it. Silly, you know, that's how it works. We always should have known that since from the 40s and the 50s. And as I say, it's this that, together with the colleagues I mentioned earlier, you know, that we've gradually been sort of almost embarrassedly putting together and realizing, well, actually, that's how it works. And it's probably got something to do with the kind of aversion within our field to affect and to subjectivity and, you know, to the stuff that the departments like English literature, you know, always did and probably always will know so much more about than we do. So that's how we see it, and at least that's how the group of colleagues that I mentioned earlier, how those of us who are working on this theory, this is how we see it. We think that consciousness in its totality is generated here and then lends its, by activating these forebrain corticothalamic mechanisms, It, as it were, samples those representations and lends consciousness to them. It sort of projects us into our representations, which are intrinsically unconscious. I mean, I really hope I don't need to argue that. You know, this is like absolutely, definitely established in a million ways that all of that cognitive stuff happens without consciousness. What it being activated by these structures adds is the possibility of your being able to feel your way into it. So now that leads to this question. I've said, what is the consciousness for? Well, you know, what I've done in this little drawing here, the red structures, these are body monitoring, body regulating structures. The hypothalamus is the big ticket item. but in this area, postrema, the nucleus solitarius over there, parabrachial nucleus, the circumventricular organs, those structures are directly related to monitoring the internal milieu and the bodily economy. They in turn project to these purple structures, not comprehensively represented here. I'm just wanting you to be able to see things like the dorsal raphe nucleus, nucleus locus ceruleus, ventral tegmental area, also these non-specific diencephalic structures over here, which in turn activate the forebrain. These are thought, and this is theory, these are thought to be connected to these body monitoring structures, because how are you doing homeostatically, how are you doing in relation to these many parameters of the vital needs of the body, salt, sugar, oxygen, water, temperature, and so on. How are you doing in relation to these things? You have to have some sort of way of monitoring it as a subject. How am I doing? Am I doing well? Am I doing badly within a biological scale of values? And according to this theory, feelings evolved as a jolly good way of being able to determine how you're doing. Anything that's good for your survival and reproductive success, monitored in this way, feels good. It's pleasurable. Anything bad for your survival and reproductive success, measured in this way, feels bad. So you avoid doing those things which feel bad. You prefer to do those things that feel good. Why? Because it enhances your chances of surviving and reproducing, and that's what consciousness is for. These are very basic, 525 million years old, those structures. We share them with all vertebrates. Above them are these limbic structures, which are more complex. It's not a simple matter of monitoring the here and now in the James Langer sense of the word, of your bodily economy, but built-in stereotyped behavioral compulsions like fear and rage and exploratory foraging and maternal care and attachment bonding and so on, all of them with unique neuroanatomies and unique neurochemistries and unique feeling states that go with them that compel us to behave in certain ways. These are varieties of pleasure and unpleasure, which are properties of these limbic circuits. It's not a matter only of here and now. It's also these built-in structures, as I say, that, again, intrinsic properties of brain generating these emotional types of consciousness, which in turn give rise to learning. So if I take, just for example, this, what we call the wanting circuit or the seeking circuit, the so-called badly named brain reward circuit, this dopaminergic circuit here in the medial forebrain bundle, this thing motivates the animal, us included, to go out into the world to seek to satisfy our needs. There you learn what actually satisfies your needs, likewise in relation to fear, built-in mechanisms as to how to deal with noxious stimuli, but then you have to learn, in addition to the inbuilt ones, you have to learn about all sorts of noxious things that you couldn't, that evolution couldn't have predicted. And so this whole forebrain business adds detail, adds content to this basic inbuilt tools for living coming from this instinctual affective pole of the mind. And feeling your way into these representations is how the things that you couldn't predict, how you start to add meaning to them, how you start to grade them. Is this good? Is this bad? You have to feel your way into these things in order to be able to know what they mean, to know what to do with them, to know how to respond to them, and all of the complexities that come with this. That's what conscious cognition is for, is our hypothesis. Conscious cognition is there in order for you to be able to feel your way through life's problems. Once you've solved a problem, once you know how to get to work, for example, you don't keep on thinking, is this good, is this the right way, is this bad? You know, you automatize it. And here we move to the famous unconscious cognition and unconscious memory. You only need explicit memory, you only need episodic memory, you only need to be able to feel your way through your representations when feelings are required. But it seems as if the great aim of cognition is to get beyond these troublesome feelings and to be able to automatize things, to just know exactly how it works. So whereas at the level of the brainstem, there are these homeostatic mechanisms which, if you deviate from the set point, it feels good or it feels bad. This is how you know, gosh, this is good, this is bad. You know, these inbuilt mechanisms down here in relation to vital needs. The same sort of thing seems to happen up at the level of these corticothalamic representational processes, that it's, you have to feel your way through things when there's all this uncertainty, but then you find a solution that actually meets the need in the outside world, then the feelings can recede, and so you don't need episodic conscious explicit cognition anymore, and the whole thing gets automatized, and Bob's your uncle, and you're a zombie, and that's what your cognition's aiming for. I really think that it's kind of alarming that that does seem to be what cognition is aiming for, the absolute mastery, you know, of the environment in relation to your needs so that the feelings can be removed from the equation. Thank God that world is so unpredictable, so full of surprises, that ideal zombiedom of my cognitive colleagues never is actually reached. So now, why am I putting this picture here next to it? Well, it's because this is Freud's drawing of this same apparatus. And as you know, I am also a psychoanalyst, and I'm particularly interested in the relationship between the sorts of things that we deal with in psychoanalysis, the lived life of the mind, and the sort of stuff that we deal with in cognitive neuroscience, learning with all the wonderful tools that we have available to us these days about the same part of nature, studied from the external mechanistic point of view rather than from the subjective experiential lived life point of view. I'm very keen on drawing parallels between the two and seeing how we can correct viewpoint dependent errors. So it's very gratifying to find that Freud's id, you know, the drives, the part of the mind that responds to the demands made upon it to perform work by dint of its connection with the body, that this can be localized. You know, it's also the perceptual surfaces and the memory systems that are attached to them. These can be localized. Freud called them id and ego. And the fact that these things down here drive these things up here, you know, it's very nice to see that we can more or less dynamically localize that relationship. But the big surprise is this. Freud, as you can see from this drawing, thought of the id as being synonymous with the unconscious, or at least overlapping in very large part with what he called the unconscious. But if you think about what I told you at the beginning of this short presentation, as much as this part of the brain performs all the functions that Freud attributed to id, in fact, this part of the brain, very far from being unconscious, is the font of all consciousness and of affective consciousness, which you would think would be the part affect. Freud's pleasure principle governs down here. You know, you would think that this would also please psychoanalysts and Freudians to discover that this part of the brain, the id part of the brain, is generating all these primitive instinctual affective mechanisms, the compulsive motivations that go with them. But in fact, if Freud was claiming, as he was, that this part of the mind is unconscious, then how on earth could it be the generator of affects? In fact, how could there be a pleasure principle governing this part of the mind? What is a pleasure principle that's unconscious? I mean, what is the point of pleasure and unpleasure if you don't feel it? You know, so the great error, it appears, in Freud's this topographical model of the mind, there are many contradictions in it which are happily resolved when we realize, in fact, the part of the mind that performs the functions that Freud called id are far from being unconscious. This is, as I said, the font of all consciousness, and consciousness in the raw, its most basic form, is affect. And these primitive feelings, which represent demands upon the mind to perform work because they're problems. Something's gone wrong here. Something I can't manage. And that's what all the cognition is for. It's to learn, how do I deal with this feeling in the outside world? How do I meet the needs, solve the problems that these feelings represent? And the aim of doing all of that is, as I've said to you already, in order to render it unconscious. So the great irony is that the id is the conscious part of the mind. The function of the ego, which Freud thought of as being the conscious part of the mind, the function of the ego is to temporarily represent its workings, its cognitive doings, in consciousness so that you can feel your way through the problems, and then ultimately to automatize that cognition, to render it unconscious, which is the ideal state of affairs as far as the ego and cognition is concerned. In order to be able to, that is to say, tame all these feelings, all of these emotions, all of the demands upon the mind to perform work. So where does this leave us? And this is the last thing I'm going to say to you. Where does this leave us as far as Freud's repressed and the famous unconscious is concerned? I think that it's not a different place from the unconscious that I've spoken to you about already in relation to cognition, that you heard about earlier in relation to memory mechanisms. the unconscious of the cognitive scientists is the same place as the unconscious of the Freudians and the psychoanalysts. To sort of roughly and readily translate it into functional neuroanatomy, it's a sort of chunking down from cortex to basal ganglionic cerebellar sort of levels of functioning. This is automatizing of cognition. This is what happens with the sort of normal process that I spoke about earlier. But I think that what the repressed consists in, and this is an absolutely speculative, but I think worthy of some attention hypothesis, is that it's the same thing, but it's premature. That when you've solved a problem, like how to get to work, you can legitimately automatize the representational cognitive process involved. But if you can't solve it and you still automatize it, then you have repressed it. Why would we do that? Well, it's because there are consciousness is a very small place. You can only think about a very few things at any one point in time. So you must use it wisely. And if there are insoluble problems, there's no point in bothering your mind with the day in and day out because you're not going to get anywhere. It's best to just put it out of mind and say, well, let me get on with the things that I can deal with. In childhood, if you care to remember, there are a great many things you simply can't solve. There are a great many wants, a great many desires, a great many feelings that are generated in childhood. There's all sorts of bubbling over id things which cannot be resolved in the outside world. I'll give you a sort of an example. I'm a little 3-year-old Mark Solms, and I look at my daddy and I think, I want to be big like him. Well, you can't because you're 3. I want to go to work like him. You can't. You don't know what the hell you're doing. Nobody's going to give you a job. I want to drive a car like him. I want to be married. I want to be married to her. These things are, they're not going to happen. I want babies now. You can't. So, all the feelings and all the desires and all the hatreds and all the resentments and all the anxieties and everything that go with all of that, there's no point in pondering it all and trying to resolve it cognitively. Just automatize it and say, okay, shit, that's the way that it is. I'm not thinking about that anymore. It's then frozen in time. And then, it opens up your mind to be able to carry on with those things that you can resolve. I think that's what the repressed is. It's automatized cognitions, just illegitimately automatized. The problem hasn't been solved. What that means is the feelings still bubble out, pop out all over the place. It's what Freud famously called the threat of the return of the repressed, because your predictions, in fact, constantly lead to what Fiston calls prediction errors. And then you have this unbound energy again, then you have this free energy again, then you have the affect again. But it can't be attached to the representations that it belongs to, because those representations have been rendered unconscious. That's how I think it works. And therefore, our task as psychoanalysts, in order to allow reconsolidation to happen, in order to allow this frozen in time, wrong-headed solution, wrong-headed prediction to be revised in the light of new knowledge, is it has to be felt again. It has to be rendered into episodic memory again. It has to be with all of the feelings and all of the troubles and all of the difficulties it involves. Take a deep breath, hold your analyst's hand, not allowed to, but you know what I mean. And in this way, think your way through it again and automatize a better solution. Something like that, I think, is how it works in psychoanalysis. And I'll end just with this one last observation, which my psychoanalytic colleagues also don't like some of the things I've just told you. And I point out to them that our patients don't come to us saying, "Doctor, I'm unconscious of something. Can you please tell me what it is?" Our patients come to us saying, "I feel like this. I'm troubled by feelings. I can't cope with this feeling." And our job is to deal with those feelings by finding the right kinds of representations that can actually manage those feelings in the outside world. And in order to do that, we first have to unfreeze the repressed ones. So that's a broad brushstroke picture of how I see now unconscious memory in the Freudian sense of the word, in relation to cognitive science, and in relation to brain mechanisms of consciousness generally. And I think that we're in exciting times. Thanks very much.